So sorry, I just want to clarify the question. So metrics for assessing what?
Metrics for assessing that are we getting to what where Jay wants to go, which is, you know, taking all these various local activities that are happening and scaling them up. Are you going in the right direction? Are there many unintended consequences that are happening that are actually, you know, overwhelming the process? So what is the metric for effective? So these are upscaling effective programs into larger ecosystems. Hopefully those larger ecosystems are also effective. How do we define what is effective? Where are we trying to go towards?
Well, I feel like this question is way above my pay grade. I don't know why you're asking me. I mean, I guess, again, if we're going back to resilience theory, there are a number of kind of characteristics of resilient systems that we can kind of look at. And to make it relevant to our earlier discussion, one of them is participation, right? So, you know, we could look at various ways to assess that. And if we're talking about making academic knowledge generation and science itself more participatory, which is also, I think, what we're talking about, then I do think there are, you know, ways that we can assess that. It would require a transformation of academia, to be honest. I mean, our academic systems are not set up that way. And I think that there's a lot of change that needs to happen within our institutions as well. You know, we are talking a lot about the political system out there, so all of y'all in this room that are academics, we're hearing a lot about the political system out there that needs to change. Let's turn around and look at our institutions, and some of us are tenured faculty that have a little bit of clout. What are the things that we need to change if we really want to be doing work that makes a difference in the systems we work in and in true participation with people in our communities? I think we need to change the incentive structure in academia, because that's not what we're incentivized to do, frankly. So.
So that you touched a nerve, which I'm so fantastic that you brought up. But I do actually have something on metrics too, so don't let me forget that. But thinking about this as stakeholder-driven partnerships, and if I'm here as a stakeholder, there is a gap between how academia can collaborate with municipalities, or what you might not necessarily consider. You know, what I think of what we do at Watershed Protection is as an applied science organization. I think there's a lot of disrespect given in the academic community to organizations like mine who are actually generating a lot of really fantastic science. We publish a lot of white papers. It's not necessarily we always are publishing or taking the time or money to publish in the journals that are what you're looking at. But there's a lot of fantastic science coming out of us. At the same time, we miss opportunities in collaborating with you in academia because our funding structures, how we, a lot of times we think of academia as looking to us to pay you for research, whereas we need to basically be providing results. And I'll try to tie this back into metrics in a second. For our funders, for our taxpayers. And so I think there's a general lack of respect. We look at folks doing research and basic science as not being connected to the exact problem and as being biased against us. And at the same time, I think there's probably people. There's logistical challenges just in the way our funding cycles work relative to how you are trying to go through, you know, in academia. And I've been a bureaucrat for 2 decades, so I don't really pretend to understand it, but with tenure and students and stuff like that. So that's a really key point if we want to try to go to that next level of figuring out how we can communicate and collaborate, have a sort of more mutual respect for each other between, you know, some of those advanced municipalities and academia. There are successes. There are certainly situations where it has not been successful in my past experience, but there have been situations where it has been very successful. So just keeping that in mind, this is another good one on metrics. This is something we really challenge or struggle with all the time. And so when you think about something like water quality, urban stream restoration, which is sort of our passion, and we think about water quality metrics, it's easy for us to count how many bags we give out for folks to scoop their dog poop in, right? Because we pay for them, we have control over that. So we talk about how we're improving fecal contamination in Austin waterways by the number of plastic bags we put out into the community, because that's what we can count. And then simultaneously, rather than focusing on, well, what is the actual fecal bacteria levels in our creeks? Because it's not just that one activity, right? There's so many different factors. And so if we see just small incremental change over time, or when you layer in that climatic complexity so that, you know, bacteria levels go up and down, it looks like our programs are completely ineffective. So when we try to have real and meaningful metrics, it's so critical to track those over long periods of time. But at the same time, how do you justify to someone who's saying, I'm imposing revenue caps on you. You now have a $25 million shortfall in your budget. Figure out how you cut it, and your decision makers come to you and go, look, well, water quality hasn't changed, so this program is clearly not working. You need to do something else. And it's like, well, it actually has improved. You just can't see it in what the metrics that we're providing over the last 5 years that we monitored or whatever. So like, it's a really complex struggle between what you can measure versus what the end result is, because what you can measure can be short in time, so the solution that you're implementing versus having that desired effect. So that was a long diatribe, so I won't talk too much about that.
Yes, about metrics, I may be biased, but I think we are in the dream age. I'm very pessimistic about the solution given we are the old humans in the loop. But metrics is the moment, remember, we have sensors everywhere. And we know we must be skeptical, particularly in this room, about the smart city, autonomous cars, etc., that is really benefiting industry and not everybody. So, however, with our common goal, I would like to remind us that we have data being eaten in all ways, like noise, air quality, water, maps with computer vision at a resolution on the planet never before. And the advantage is, going back to a question on the methods, computer vision for the first time allow us to cluster cities, divide them, and help us with such multidimensional systems. So the methods of computer vision and then interdependent system networks, etc., with the ocean of data are providing us the methods. So we are very aware that that is not going to bring us a better planet. However, the opportunities to be creating the right questions and tackling the problem properly perhaps bring us back to the question of what can we do when we are from the university perspective. It shouldn't be one more paper, right? Because with all these metrics and data, you can write many more papers. But that shouldn't be what we are here for. And then that is the idea that I would like to.
Yeah, but and thank you, and that's exactly my point. It shouldn't be one more paper, but how do we get tenure and how do we get promoted? It's one more paper.
That's why
and so we can't tell the junior faculty to do this.
I don't write papers.
If we're not exercising it. Yeah, I know.
Like a $15 million SRE grant from NSF. That's something to take.
And I can certainly say, maybe for those in the system that promotes and trains faculty, that that is something that will take time, but is changing from 10 years ago to now.
Yeah.
And so it is an immobile structure that we need to get through. It's something that can be eroded if we have collectively among academics the will. And I'm not sure we do.
Yeah. We'll give the final word in the panel to Sarah and then we move to Dave.
So that makes me think, what the thing that came up to me with thinking about metrics, right, and also I was also super inspired by your comments, is we think a lot about capacity building, right, and leadership training, and something feels like there are not often enough incentives for people who come from research, especially in the academic world, to then go out and work in the regulatory entities and in, you know, and so especially out in rural areas, when we look at some of the smaller regulatory entities, there's kind of a divide there. And so we're trying to, you know, it'd be great to think about how to incentivize young people to seek jobs there and not just to write papers to seek tenure track, right? So how is it that you create an actual interface between the institutions themselves, right, in terms of what you're producing through the system. The other thing that occurs to me is, you know, especially working in small cities, a lot of times they don't have the best available science because they don't have the capacity within their staff to produce the science. And I'm going to say something that's going to sound harsh, and please don't take offense to it, but there's a perception, as you know, that a lot of academic research is disconnected from reality, right? And so that makes me think, you know, having worked in a situation where it would have been really helpful to have institutions that have the funding, for example, to develop metrics so that they can say, actually, we have tracked measurable impact, either good or bad, to this system. So maybe thinking about dedicating research projects towards assisting that directly, right? It's finding that linkage. And so that's my, like Suzanne's.
I was just going to say, like we just said, the joint thing, the success track for leadership in these rural areas to draw the kind of more intellectually trained individuals out who want to implement is to create the connectivity so that they can keep their brains working on complex problems and applications, and so they have that two-way street between the intellectual juice that keeps us alive and the implementation needs.
Yeah, we were talking about over lunch, or dessert, I guess, briefly, over the reverse brain drain, right? And how, because we, within the water world, work on a decentralized system, that I always thought it'd be really cool to support these institutions to become more attractive to young people to want to go work there because they actually get to do really real-life things that make an impact, right? And that's, I think that, they're that nurturing that relationship could be a great metric.
However, listening to this, I feel I'm a little bit squirmy in my seat and about to explode, because I kind of disagree with everything, the basic premise of people, the answer is no, and I think it has to do with, I don't really work in urban systems, and I don't even work in, like, land. So I work in the ocean, where we basically built a business around developing metrics and thresholds to support ecosystem-based decision-making. And so we have metrics and papers, a lot of papers, to support it, to give it legitimacy and people tenure, that in real journals, and it's used. It's now part of U.S. policy for marine ocean management across every part of the U.S. and the EU and Australia. And it's all based on what are the desired endpoints of interest in it, how do we develop the metrics to measure that, what are thresholds for that metrics that line up to our objectives. And it's like, that's because that's the only way you can get anything done. And so it's jointly working with the stakeholders, scientists, academic agency scientists at state, federal, and local levels to develop these metrics and to measure them. I don't know, oceans are, I'm sure, different or whatever, but like there may be lessons learned from that system that can be brought over. Because we're far behind in other areas, for sure. But maybe that area, I didn't realize that that was actually a place where there might be some opportunity to learn.
So I want to push back just really gently. I wonder if in the oceans, right, in terms of priorities, right, political will, prior and all the different conflicting things we've been talking about in the oceans, the priority there is that we're all going to die if we don't figure it out. So maybe there's already kind of incentive for people to collectively figure it out.
Priorities make money. Priorities kill as many fish as you can. And the law is kill as many fish as you can, but don't screw things up. And then there's ESA. And so how do you maximize economic yield on the oceans while still maintaining some semblance of ecological health? Also, how do you think about, so that's in the water, but also you have to think about the well-being both of individuals and communities and equity across. So certain policies create consolidation of business, maximize profits, but create inequality. So how do you measure all that? And how do you track it? And how do you sort of evaluate potential alternative future management strategies? So that as scientists, you can go in and say, here's what you should do. It's exactly what you're saying, which is, here's your objective. Here's where you're at. Here's the different possibilities that you've come up with for us to get there and here. And here's where we think the likely outcome is at. with uncertainty.
So, okay, moving on from there, that's a good segue to one final broad question that I had, and this has been a good participatory panel, so I'd like in that spirit also. So I first wanted to talk a little bit about this lunch conversation I was having with Maria about when she does her the complex models with agent-based systems, and then she works
Moira.
With participatory.
Moira.
Okay. And thank you. And then when she works with participatory models, to what extent do stakeholders want to see the engine versus they're okay with driving the car without understanding what is going on in the engine? And that may or may not be the right example here also. So in the sense that, you know, some of the systems that we deal with, and somebody like Charles can comment on that with all the uncertainty work he does, are very complex, a lot of uncertainties, a lot of possibilities, ensembles. And how does that then translate to how much the stakeholder needs to, should understand about all of this? Should, in the sense, if the stakeholder can understand, okay, here is everything, but they have other things, other priorities. So how much of that can be understood? How much of that can be communicated both ways? That this is something we absolutely need to understand, versus this, okay, it's a black box, but as long as it works. So sort of that bridge, if you will, and since, I mean, I know you're trying to say something, sorry we didn't come to you, but now I think with your fuzzy causal link participatory modeling, if you could start with that, and this question can be open, and with the panelists and others, all of us can discuss, but if you could start, please, ma'am.
So I don't have a clean answer. I think it really very much depends on the audience. And so stakeholders can be super sophisticated science-trained people. And of course, they would want to absolutely see what's under the hood and not just drive the car. Whereas other stakeholders might say, okay, I have enough trust in this process and in the people involved that I believe the model and I just want to kind of work with it. I think my bigger comment, if I may, which is a little bit back to Phil's as well, is that I think as scientists, we're making a huge mistake right now. A lot of the conversation goes around, well, if people just had better appreciation of the science and understood the problem, then they would solve the problem. And a newsflash, I mean, there is not a big discussion about love of climate change denial in the country of Germany that I happen to know quite well. I think we're still not convinced that Germany is doing enough to counteract climate change. And I think the issue is that's a very US problem, that we are on the denial level. Non-denial does not lead to action. And I think as scientists, the stance of, well, all I do is give you kind of the facts, and then you need to know what you want to do, and you figure it out, and then you propose alternatives, and I'm willing to run the model and let you know which alternatives has what outcomes, is a stance we can't afford. And no engineer on the planet would say, well, I'm just giving you all the facts, but build the solution yourself. Engineers build solution all the time. And I think there's a real opposition to taking action, because it's not clear to people what action they can actually take. It's very diffuse to them. And I don't think we can take the stance of, well, here are all the facts, figure it out. I think we need to be more solution building and propose actual alternatives.
And again, it's around the issue of value. So it's not only about solutions, but again, the trade-offs, who gains, who benefits, who loses. And we've got to figure that out. We've got to deliberate around that. So it is a deliberation that we are part of. So that's perhaps what the message is.
But I do think we also need to simply generate solutions,
sure.
Ideas.
Yes.
Okay, Phil, and then you, and then Charles.
So it reminded me of one of my favorite processes that I got to do is, it was in California, so, you know, liberal. But there was something called the Green Light Protection Act, which the state passed an act that required the creation of marine reserves. So how do you decide where you're gonna close off these areas from human access, essentially? it was very controversial, but the way they did it, which was quite innovative, I thought, was basically they said, here's what you have to do. The law says you will do this. You stakeholders need to achieve this goal, and achieving this goal means you have to meet the following criteria. You tell us what to do. So they would develop plans that then came to a scientific panel. We had models, whatever. We said, okay, here's your plan. This is how well it worked. Here's where it fell short. We'd like to revise your plan, blah, blah, blah. And eventually, you get a pile of plans. All, they're very different because they come from different people with different values. They all work. And then it went to the policymakers to decide actually what to do from among these, this whole process. It was really interesting because it was like it was, the scientists weren't hunting. They were saying, yeah, you're, the law says you're going to, you know, achieve this, and we'll tell you if you did or you didn't based on these models. And the models, by the way, it eventually became open access, and these are friendly interfaces and such, so stakeholders actually do it themselves. But it's really cool, I thought, and reminding you said, it was similar to, I think, what you were talking about yesterday, in the sense that you have these bottom-up processes that are still are responding to the greater good.
Somebody
talk
about
this
on your
Yeah, I just wanted to build up some of the other points that when we're talking about from a theoretical perspective building these models, right, it's helpful to think about it as a maximization problem. Unfortunately, we don't have a really easy sort of profit maximization for all communities and all systems, right? But we do need to build in constraints like we would a normal maximization problem, except that these need to be political constraints, they need to be organizational capacity constraints, they need to be financial constraints, right? We can't look to a city to implement a policy that they don't have the capacity to implement. And so it's not just a sort of figure out the physical engineering and hand them the solution without considering whether that's politically feasible at all, right? Or whether they have the financial capacity to do it or the staff to do it, right? So if we think about sort of building these models with these political and organizational capacity type measures, we'll be able to produce solutions that are much more likely to be adopted than if we didn't.
Rand's group for decision-making under deep uncertainty is a good example of doing exactly that. So it's a stakeholder participatory process by which you develop those constraints in collaboration with the stakeholders. I agree.
As is the system that Marissa just alluded to, which is how we set groundwater policy in Texas. So all of our water policy or the regional planning, both the surface water and groundwater, is stakeholder-based. But groundwater specifically is in different regions, stakeholders coming together, and these are technical and non-technical people, but assisted by scientists in running models, decide basically on the difference between maximum production of your groundwater resources and sustainable yield, and then a whole bunch of socio-political negotiations to determine somewhere in between, right? And then they all have to check out with the state agency whether or not they're feasible, right? So they have to work, but they may not reflect. They may reflect closer to maximum production. They may reflect closer to sustainable yield. None of them reflect anywhere close to sustainable yield. But I think it calls into question, what is the objective? The objective in Texas of groundwater management is not sustainable yield. That is not the objective. The objective is you decide how you want to allocate it based on all of these socio realities. And so that's how it's done.
And since 97, the culture in Texas for water is to have stakeholder processes to make decisions. And the incentive is in state law. And the incentive is that if you don't want to get together and make your decision, then the state's going to do it for you. Nobody wants the government doing it for them, so everybody does it.
Charles, you have been patient.
So I raised my hand a while ago, and I want to remind people what the question was back when I had my thought. So it makes sense. So the question was, to what extent should individuals get their hands dirty in the modeling? And I have an answer to that, which is that we as scientists need to be able to communicate our understanding in a, and I think one of the goals, let's say, of NSF is usually, or one of the metrics, if you will, is understanding. And I do also think that, so in climate, with the complex system like aerosols, when I hear a colleague express his understanding of how aerosols are affecting cloud dynamics, he has to do it to somebody who's not an expert in that. And usually we can recognize when a person has understanding because of the way they're able to connect the different pieces together. And then usually you have trust in that individual to have sorted out all the important pieces. So when it comes, I would say this is an opinion, when it comes to stakeholders and to what extent do you need to make a model complex or not, I think in the end, the currency needs to be the understanding gained from what could be a complex system to the important linkages that go from the drivers to your policy choices to the impacts that has. That understanding in the end needs to be clear.
Yes. Just to jump on that, yeah, so we've used from experience taken black box empirically based derived models for water quality treatment, stormwater treatment, and then scale them up on a citywide basis to inform the first generation of our water quality regulations for development. And maybe they were horribly, horribly wrong because we didn't understand, we didn't connect back to the fundamental theoretical and engineering processes that were occurring and that were actually driving those. And so we've made some pretty significant mistakes in the development of our regulations because we took models that worked fantastic for that limited data set and then applied them incorrectly. And I think there are good examples, even in the fisheries world, where folks have developed models in isolation. And so there has to be some degree of balance between the folks applying the model and understanding the fundamental physics underlying it. But at the same time, I think that they don't have to be experts because you can involve them, kind of, the participatory modeling, you can involve them in the creation of the modeling so that you're designing the tool that's maximizing whatever objective that is meaningful to them or relevant to the management measure that you're trying to take. Those tools to inform decision making, to understand how those trade-offs occur, I think are really valuable for folks who are trying to take the best available information to actually make objective decisions. But I completely agree with what you're saying. This is not a lack of data problem. Like spending time embellishing the problem statement and going and refining that is not what we need right now. It's more of what you were suggesting. The majority of Americans believe climate change is occurring, is man-made, and is a significant problem now and into the future. So it's not this disconnect from our government, but it's not the problem. It's understanding the problem is not the problem.
Wait, but it is a problem because, I mean, it's not in agreement on a global conceptual scale, no problem, we know it's a problem. Problem is diagnosis, that's our issue right now, is diagnosing it down to a level that you can actually provide informative and relevant decision variables, informative and relative constraints, and sub-objective problem formulation so that you can tell people, like, you want to fix the aerosol problem, you want to fix the pollution in schools along transportation corridors, like, give people actionable knowledge, so you take all of the data and all of the high-level conceptualization, it has to now be, we have to dialogue with each other for a long time probably, and it's going to be the thing that scientists and engineers hate the most because dialogue is very ambiguous and cloudy and fuzzy. You have to drive them to converge towards a deliberative process across any number of different topics that are challenges that we have to face and confront. So it's a diagnosis issue and an actionability problem. Sorry. I feel a little passionate about that.
Chris, if that's not the problem, then why is there no hope at the state legislature level? So let me just tilt against this window.
Yeah. Oil and gas law.
Again. Yeah. Oh, thanks.
Money.
Yeah. Right. So, like Charles, I want to remind everyone of the question that Ruth posed at the very beginning of this panel. What is the challenges of scaling things up? And the state legislature, and you guys rightly said, well, there's no hope. So that leaves me with, in an ideal world, right, what would the hope be? That we could educate the populace so that in a generation of this education, everyone would be old enough to vote, and then they'd vote out everyone who's in, and then the state legislature would be the body that it needs to be serving people's needs. Right?
Well, that's,
so let me just pose the, these are all hypothetical. I'll just pose three hypotheticals, right? That's one. Another is the environmental disasters are so intense that everyone says, oh, of course, now we have to act. And this is hard on the heels of a historical drought this decade, an historical flood on the heels of Hurricane Harvey, right? And what's the, what's a third possibility of doing this? Maybe it's marketing, right? But marketing is expensive. It's not something scientists normally do. So should this be $3 million out of the $50 million budget in the NSF proposal is for marketing?
But governance structures don't have to rely solely on government, right? So I mean, you were talking about governance structure, which is critical. So we have to have ability where we're making decisions. I think it's kind of what you were alluding to. We have to have the ability to monitor the effectiveness so we can do truly adaptive management. But like, I think what we have to stop doing is looking at government to start making these, to step in and fulfill that role. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really choose
to. Yeah, and just to add, from a complex systems perspective, I always like to say this, you know, quote John Sturman of MIT, that complex systems have no boss, right? So we're thinking very hierarchically in the sense of these people up here have to make a decision and then it will solve the problem. But in complex systems, solutions and levers of change can arise from any layer. And right now in the US, it's actually local efforts that are leading the climate adaptation and climate mitigation charge, I would say. And to some extent, states too. Look at what California is doing. Right? So no, we don't have leadership maybe here at the state scale of Texas. No, we don't have leadership at the federal scale. But I don't think that means all hope is lost. It means you have to work at these different scales to find those levers of change that are going to percolate up or down or out.
Exactly, but how much easier would it be if those governing bodies were on board? Not to say we're making these decisions, we're making these solutions, they're saying we're empowering you to get together and coordinate.
Are we, you know, if you think about it, we had it in the previous administration and still we couldn't go that far. So it really has to happen at different levels, you know. You know, it's not going to be top down either. And it's not that things help.
Exactly.
I feel like we keep talking about people as a bug and not a feature.
And when you talk about them as a bug, it sort of implies that like we can solve that or like the problem can be obviated. And I think that's kind of silly.
When we say that we can vote in all the right people, there's still arguments to be had about how to do things, right? And that's why we have politics, that's why we have government, it's a tool just like science is. And so like scientists can tell us what we should do, but science can't. Right, and people still have to arbitrate that. And so I think, so like, if you have an engineering solution, it's not politically feasible, then it's not a solution, right? It's an idea, but part of whether it's a good idea or not is whether it is feasible and whether you can implement it. And so I think that's, it's important to stop talking about politics as a bug.
Please be.
But, you know, politics is malleable, right? So it's not like right now we have a certain political context. Yes, but it changes, and we can change it. That's what, you know, I think that we really need to have or start having that conversation. We are political, too, and I think that it's not a bad thing. I think it can be a very good thing, and I think that we just have to engage in that, you know?
100%.
So it's not fixed.
I think the tension, actually, and, you know, we talk a lot about in Texas how you do conservation within a conservative state. I alluded to that yesterday. Or conservation efforts related, and it is typically a more conservative-oriented political discussion at the Texas legislature. And yet you find them taking remarkably progressive steps on some things when it's taken outside of that political continuum.
Right.
You know, the stakeholder ground-up process is, I think, remarkably progressive.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I observe sometimes that you need that political tension, that continuum, to drive the whole wheel forward, right? So I think back on what you said earlier in the conversation about, well, we're just thinking about legislature and regulatory entities, but they're all these different decision-making processes, right? And just as a family in Switzerland, right, and they, my mom says constantly, she's like, why is it that when I walk into a grocery store, I have to choose between the products that are good for the environment and the products that are bad for the environment? She's like, why is that, why do I have to decide that as a citizen as opposed to regulatory entities making that decision for me? Like, why is the decision not just made? And I think that you have to see everybody has a place in the continuum. including academics, including regulators, including the legislature, and it all helps drive the conversation forward. So figure out where your point of tension is.
And it's interesting how some of the science challenges, questions versus some of the perceptions, stakeholders, and I think you were saying that it's very specific. So what I have seen, for example, from Department of Defense is something very different. And we are involved in the quadrennial defense review at some point where they're mandated by Congress to include climate change aspects. So back, just to give a little bit of context, back to Susan's point about, you know, we need to drive towards actionable information. And sometimes it's not that easy for us. So I think about, okay, climate change, is it happening? Absolutely, yes. I mean, what's the big, you know, I mean, just, it is happening. But then when you say, what is going to happen to surface water in even Texas, forget about Austin, there are uncertainties, and we have to understand that, right? There was a 2012 paper in Science magazine which said, you know, forecasting regional models flunks their first test or something like that. That was obviously a news article, sort of the headline was a little bit bloated, but still. Recently, there was an article, so if you're talking about data analytics, there was this article by Michael Jordan, who is a very famous computer scientist, and the second most famous Michael Jordan. said something like, you know, AI is not ready yet in terms of providing engineering solutions. So that's one side of it. I mean, it's not, I mean, again, these are statements made to create an impact. But then when you get to, so when I was in this, you know, room full of sort of Department of Defense, very senior folks, this was their quadrennial defense review. We went as a team from Oak Ridge Lab. And I was much younger then, so I was the one talking about uncertainty, and then at some point this many-star general comes to me and says, and somehow this did not come across as condescending at all, and I mean, I was younger too, but said, son, we understand uncertainty. Trust me, we deal with more uncertainty on a daily basis than all this uncertainty. However, don't minimize that. Characterize it as best as you can, and then let us deal with that. So that was a DoD stakeholder, and even under various politics and administration, they somehow managed to do, so far at least, what they want to do. I don't know about all stakeholders, so I know that there are various constraints. Stakeholders.
Well, I can give you an example of the opposite.
Yeah, of course, yes.
So, in this case of air pollution that I mentioned yesterday, so actually the Department of Public Health made a study, the first of its kind, because they were trying to figure out, you know, the cancer cluster in the area around this plant. And some of the observations were like, you know, 90% above, you know, what would be expected as an average if they're, you know, in terms of, you know, cancer incidence in that area. So 90% over, you know, cancer cases of, you know, say breast cancer and some other kinds of cancer that are associated to exposure to this contaminant. But then there were other cancers that, you know, that were weird because in the studies they were not related to exposure to this contaminant. And so then there was a phrase that they put, because of course it's a public health study, it says, well, there's, you know, some uncertainty and more studies are needed, because they have to say that. So then the politicians and the company held on to that phrase to say, ah, see, there's uncertainty, so that you can't prove that there's a connection between our emissions and the cancers in this neighborhood. And that, so pushing for, like, just staying open and continuing emitting, because, again, holding on and taking advantage, capitalizing on that uncertainty. So that is really a key aspect of the work that we do, that we need to, that we're marketing, would be useful. Because we've got to communicate this in a way that is not, you know, manipulated. To just maintain things the way they are.
Jay is standing up, which tells me that are we about
to stretch? That's all.
So if we have, oh, there's one. Can we take a few questions?
One more question.
Just one comment is that in my experience working with people and working with stakeholders, so of course it's just my experience. But in my experience working with people from lots of different backgrounds, one input does not equal a specified output. When I'm talking to people of multiple backgrounds and perspectives and lived experiences. And then I'm sure if I was having that the same conversation at different levels, you know, talking about the city of Austin, talking about the Central Texas region, talking about the state of Texas, one input isn't going to equal the same output, even if I'm probably talking to the same person. So it's just something to remember that in all of these conversations that we have, I think we have a lot of, or I have a tendency, also speak only from my personal experience, I have a tendency to try to create taxonomies because it helps me to understand and organize the world. But when I'm talking to people and interacting with people, people are so much more dynamic and they're going to change from minute to minute. So it's just something to have to remember all the time. I just say that just, I have to remember that so I don't feel hopeless in interactions. Just remember that.
What a great note to end on.
Yes. Right. Yes. Thank
let's
you. Thank
let's
you
thank
much.
The panel very much.
That was a great discussion. So we have our next workshop, and we have coffee break. So let's make it 5 minutes for coffee. And we'll make that. Thank you. All right.